One of my greatest values and priorities for holding both is to foster community. I offer multiple support and process groups that are held from the vantage point of an occupational therapist who specializes in mental health and women's health. I call these my support circles. In May, the Complete Circle begins. This group is tailored to those deciding to end their secondary infertility journey without a second child. This will be a safe space to hold gratitude for motherhood as it is, even though it looks different than one might have pictured initially. The topic of this podcast aligns with the theme of this group. If this is relatable to you and you would like more information, please email me at allie@holdingbothllc.com. That is allie@holdingbothllc.com, or follow the link in the show notes to learn more. Hi, my name is Allie. Welcome to the Secondary Infertility Podcast. I'm an occupational therapist with training in mental health, women's health, and health literacy. I experienced secondary infertility and loss myself, and I know that there is complexity in holding both the joys of motherhood and the pain and yearning that comes along with infertility at the same time. I want to be a conversation catalyst for this very important topic. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome back to the Secondary Infertility Podcast. I'm Allie, and today I'm here with Alexandria Grant Presser. She is trying to her best to manage being a preschooler mom, serving as a clinical director, and keeping her fiddle leaf alive. She holds a Master's of Science degree in Applied Developmental Psychology, specializing in behavioral health in schools and communities, and a certificate in Applied Behavioral Analysis from the University of Pittsburgh. She is passionate about analyzing and creating environments that best serve Black children and communities and helping them reach moments of joy. She experiences joy when she watches children play, through writing short stories and essays, and through seeing Black folks win. Welcome, Alexandria.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm very excited for this conversation. Ever since I found your Instagram page, I just felt like this would be such a good conversation, and I'm glad that we connected. So let's get started. I want you to tell me a little bit more about your professional background and your career path.
100%. So as you read, right, my degree is in applied developmental psychology, and I am a behavior analyst, which is basically just taking what we know about the science of behavior and analyzing the relationship between behavior and the environment, and then applying it in various ways. And since my master's in applied developmental psychology, I've always applied my knowledge and what we know about behavior in the environment to children, families, and communities. And it's funny because like you asked me like about my profession and career path, and like I can talk about like where I am right now, but I find it even cooler to talk about the journey because I've been blessed to be able to like do this in a variety of ways. One of my very first jobs out of college that I loved was I was actually a play advocate.
That's amazing. Tell us about that. Oh, yeah.
As awesome as it sounds. And so essentially what I did was I worked with a nonprofit organization, you know, called Trying Together. But when I was there, it was called the Pittsburgh Association for the Education of Young Children. And ultimately what my job was to specifically look at advocating for, you know, developmentally appropriate play for children, and that being either in the curriculum. I would look and find play deserts, which is like these spaces that where children didn't have access to play, or play spaces that were safe in their community, and then advocating and working alongside the community, but also then the city, in order to think creatively about how we embed play in everyday spaces so that way children had access to them.
That's incredible. I've never heard the term play desert. So would that include places that don't have playgrounds or safe areas?
Yeah, so exactly. So that would be that there is not a walkable distance to a playground for a child or a family, and or there wasn't a walkable distance to like an open area, a safe open area of land that had adequate lighting that children could bring something and engage in play. So I worked alongside a couple of communities, and I got to work with children
And then we thought creatively, like we started to think about, okay, how can a library become a play hub and a place that has a play desert? What are places that children and their families consistently come in contact with? And then how do we make them play spaces like a bus stop or like a crosswalk or okay. like a vegan lot? How do we take a vegan lot and make it something that is playful? And this sort of connected specifically to my passion around supporting and cultivating environments of joy for Black and Brown children and families, because we primarily saw deserts, play deserts, and places where Black and Brown families existed and lived for various reasons for why that was. But it was a really fun and awesome opportunity to like take applied behavior analysis, right? Because that's how you use the relationship between the environment and behavior, right? Like, what is keeping children from being able to have access to play? What are the systems that are involved? Okay, where do people come in contact with, and how can we build spaces of joy? So that was like sort of my first.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, yeah. Being able to take your professional background and get out into the community. And what I believe, I mean, I don't have a background in applied behavioral analysis, but what I believe to be like an untraditional but creative way, yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like an untraditional path that's so important.
Yes. 110%. Yeah. And we all can take the things that we're passionate about and enjoy and love and sort of like utilize them in untraditional ways right? And then you can do the next piece, which is talking about like, why is this untraditional? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, what are the systems that be that makes this an untraditional path or journey? And so that's sort of like where I started. And then I moved into working alongside children and adolescents with neurodivergence and those who experience mental health crises. And so I worked for a pilot program where essentially the county was trying to solve a problem. And the problem was that they would have, you know, children that reoccurringly were being admitted into psychiatric hospitals. And they realized that these were children that, you know, utilize all of the county resources, but right, would still come into the psychiatric hospital. And so this pilot program was put in place of like, okay, what are we missing? What are the things that we need to have in order to prevent this from happening? And so I was part of a mobile treatment team that went in and provided, you know, behavioral, but like holistic psychiatric, you know, social worker, everybody in order to support the child and the family. And provide them with the therapeutic resources that they need, not only to like decrease going back into psychiatric hospital, but for then these families and children to feel like they could be connect with their community and support systems that were already in place. So I did that for a while.
Then how incredible too to be yeah. able to bridge that gap in between. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm sorry, what were you gonna say?
Oh, no. So yeah, so that was, it was great because I got, again, I was put into a situation which was seemed like an untraditional pathway for applied behavior analysis or what people think about psychology, which just encouraged me to be able to think creatively and do things differently because there was no precedence really. Mm-hmm. And so it was great. I learned so much. I learned how to coach and work with support staff. I got to learn sort of the history and the community of residential staffing, which was something I had not been a part of. So it was really enjoyable. So yeah, but then I was going to say, and then I moved and I sort of moved and I started to work in a school district, which I enjoyed as well. And my job was to support teachers and oh, wow. really work with them on, okay, how do we develop and build classroom environments that best support children? And specifically children in special education, in special education classrooms. And I got a chance to like really teach about culturally responsive behavior practices. And what does that mean from the individual, but then in your classroom, and then from like a site-wide, like school district or, you know, your building type of perspective. So that was sort of where I went until COVID.
Oh, yeah. I feel like that shook things up a lot for people.
It 100%. And like, and I worked through COVID working in a school district. Yeah. During COVID, which was a whole nother thing that, you know, again, untraditional, unprecedented. My son was young during that period of time. And so after that and doing that, I was like, I need to take a little bit of a break. And that's why I came into my current job. I'm a clinical director for a behavioral health organization. Yeah. And we use applied behavior analysis to provide therapeutic services to children with complex or multisensory disabilities. So I do know American Sign Language. And so I work with children with deaf blindness, children with cortical vision impairments, and then children also disabilities or different neurodivergence like autism, ADHD, and anxiety. So yeah.
Wow. I feel like you've done such a wide variety of things. That's amazing.
Absolutely. I did. Thank you. But like, the golden thread, though, is still developing and finding systems that bring kids joy. So as long as that's there, I've enjoyed it.
You know, and I find that when I look at your Instagram page, which we'll get into this and your infertility journey next, but I see that you're using your knowledge in psychology to be a good support for people and your writing. I know that you, in your bio, you mentioned that you enjoy writing short stories, which we'll also get into. But when I look at your Instagram page, I can see that your professional background in there, and I can see just your beautiful writing. One that comes to mind is that you said the secondary infertility journey, you likened it to standby on a plane and traveling. That's one of my favorite posts that I've seen you do. So let's get into talking about your secondary infertility journey, starting wherever you feel comfortable starting.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that. And I think I have to start at the beginning, right? Because I think, right, when you talk about secondary infertility, one, I feel like people sort of like forget that there is secondary infertility. Mm-hmm. And
I agree.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had my first son. He's now 4. And, you know, that journey, you know, we weren't able to get pregnant on our own. And I had hyperemesis during my first journey. So it was sort of like a love-hate relationship. Like there was definitely gratitude just in this idea of like, I can carry my own son. This is great. But it definitely was not what, like, you know, the books or what folks would say, right? Like people would look at me and be like, oh my gosh, you're glowing. And you're not like, and I'm just like, no, I vomited that sweat. But thank you so much for trying to make me feel better about this.
I can imagine that made the pregnancy very, very tough.
Yeah, it was very difficult. And I was in pain a lot. I was exhausted. I could eat maybe one or two things during that period of time. And I think one of the big things, though, was, you know, I think people think, yes, about the vomiting in that piece. But I also then had like a ton of ligament pain, right? Because like I'm not gaining weight during that period of time. And so I felt like a lot of pulling. And I was just told that that's normal. That's fine. Which really started to introduce me into like, what does medical gaslighting look like, unfortunately? Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of times during my first pregnancy that I was told, you're good, you're fine. Actually, up into his birth, where I was like, my first kid, I'm like, I feel like something is different. I feel like something is wrong. And they're like, no, you were just in here. We did a cervical check. It's probably just connected to the cervical check. And I was like, no, I feel like this is different. I feel like it's wrong. And they're like, you're fine. Went to work that day. I came back
and I was like,
I'm reeling in a lot of pain. And finally, you know, my husband came home. We went to the doctor and they're like, oh, no, honey, like you're in labor. Like you're 5 centimeters dilated. And I'm at 34 weeks. So, right, we are premature. And it would have been interesting if I had gone in a little bit earlier, like what the outcome would have been. But there was a lot of like, you're perfectly okay. This is your first child. You're just overreacting.
Gosh, that's so frustrating and hard when it's your first and you really, truly don't know.
Correct.
And you knew, I mean, you had a knowing, but it's like when you're trusting someone or you're that should know to guide you, that's,
Exactly. And exactly, especially when it's your first child. Because like, I remember them asking me like, are they contractions? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I've never had them before. So like, what an odd question to ask to somebody who's never experienced it. And so like I would try to describe it in the best way that I could. And then it was like, yeah, no, you're good. So we went to the hospital not expecting to have a baby. And then we had a baby. And my son was delivered via emergency C-section. And like that is where my birth trauma sort of started, was his heart rate was dropping. And he was also premature. And so, we were rushed back. And luckily, you know, luckily my husband was able to make it with us. They at first assumed that he was not my husband because I'm in an interracial relationship. And so they looked at my husband like, you're the father? And he's like, yeah, hi. Didn't hear him the whole time. So luckily they were able to get him back, but they were rushing so fast that like they had already started. But then, you know, my child was a preemie, so he had to be moved to the NICU. And so a decision had to be made that my husband went to the NICU to be with my son, and then I was by myself. And I was so exhausted, right? I don't remember a ton because I worked that day because I didn't think that I was going to have a baby. And so I worked a full day of work. And then I went and I, you know, was in labor and had a child. And so by the time we got to me being on the table, I was so tired. I definitely like fell asleep. And so it wasn't until we started to move towards having, like really thinking about having our second, that like I started to go to a different OBGYN because I knew that if we were going to have a second child, I wanted to be with a different OBGYN, somebody who would maybe listen to me.
Because I wasn't important. Listening.
Yeah. And I was telling her about my history and my journey, and her eyes got really wide. And she goes, you don't know what happened to you, do you? And I remember being like, what? I'm sorry, what? And she's like, yeah. The way that you're talking about this, you don't fully know what happened to you. And she prints out the OR report and hands it to me and says, I want you to read it and then I will describe it.
Oh and my gosh, what an incredible doctor.
Yeah. One to like notice that like the way, because it would have been very easy to just be like, maybe she's just not telling me. But like the fact that like she could play detective to figure out that like I was missing such big parts that she was like, there's no way that you know. And so, you know, she handed this to me and I start to read it and I realized that like I hemorrhaged, I had a lot of blood. There was, you know, a lot of concern about like putting certain parts back and all of that. And so it was a lot more traumatic than we thought. And so it was like reopening up a story and being like, wow, I missed like half the plot. Like, this is why you don't read Cliff Notes. Like, this is why you have to read the book. And so I remember sitting there and being like, and just reading it over and over again and being like, okay, wow. All righty. So this is where it is. And so then it just opened up a whole host of things after that. Like, I had pain. I've always had pain.
Prior to your first birth, you had pain? Or
so I had a little bit of pain prior, but mostly after. And I was dismissed afterwards about like, you just had a baby. Like, it's going to take a while for like everything to like come back. And so we went on this journey of trying to figure out what was causing my pain, like this pain in my abdomen. And I did pelvic floor physical therapy. Mm-hmm. Anybody who needs to do that. Highly recommend.
Me too.
Yeah. So pelvic floor physical therapy, I did, you know, the dry needling, everything. And then finally we got to a point where she was like, all right, let's do a laparoscopy. And we do the laparoscopy and we find out that my uterus and my bladder are like fused together via incisions. And like she takes pictures of it and she's looking at it and she's like, whoa, hold up. And so she obviously like removes all, like detaches, like unfuses them all together. But that was reason for like pain that I had for like over a year and a half, like almost 2 years, and just being completely dismissed around it. And finally having somebody who believed me and was like, yeah, let's take a look. And I remember feeling like, I'm not crazy. There's something that's there. But another crazy part of this story is I was also told that during that procedure that a hysteroscopy was done, right? And that's when you go in and you look specifically like around like the uterus. And so I went under the assumption that that was completed. We did letrozole 6 rounds.
Wait, did you... You were under the assumption that the hysteroscopy was at the same time as the laparoscopy?
Okay. That is correct. Yeah.
So then you moved on to letrozole?
So we moved on to letrozole with the assumption, right, like everything else is fine because we're like, okay, well, I still can't get pregnant, right? Like, check, we know what's gone with the pain. Awesome. Mm-hmm. But still can't get pregnant. And so we did 6 rounds of letrozole, which is a lot.
It's a lot.
And was like, exhausted, right? Mm-hmm. Wait during that time, and then finally found an REI, reproductive endocrinologist, And then we did hysteroscopy number two because we were finding that, like, I would do the, like, I could, like, they couldn't do the HSG procedure. Like, I had four or five doctors come in. They could not get the catheter in. They could not figure it out. They're like, what in the world, right? I'm drinking water to try to, like, move my bladder. They really tried.
So painful. Yeah.
I was there for 2 hours. It's supposed to be like a 15-minute procedure. I was there for 2 hours. And my husband's just like hanging out in the car, jamming to music. But they were like, nah, we're going to have to do this under sedation. We'll do it through a hysteroscopy. Hysteroscopy number two occurs. And that's where we find that I have a ridiculous amount of scarring in my uterine cavity, which starts to bring up the question of this would have been seen if a hysteroscopy occurred the first time. And actually, when I go back and I look at the records and people have brought it to my attention, is that, like, in the records, it says, then we move to the hysteroscopy and then there's nothing dictated after.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, nothing is said. There are no pictures. And so, like, there's a part that, like, of me that doesn't know. I don't know if it just wasn't dictated or I don't know if it was just not completely done. However, the amount of damage that was in my uterine cavity would be hard not to see that it, if it was done. So, yeah. So hysteroscopy number two happened and I was diagnosed with Asherman syndrome. And just for folks who don't know what that is, it's like when the uterus does this like crazy thing where it makes bands of like micro, like bands of adhesions in the uterine cavity. And so in my case, these adhesions, right, it prevents, you know, an egg from attaching because there's no place to attach to because it's all just filled with adhesions and scarring. And so we found out that's the reason for my infertility is this piece of Asherman syndrome.
And sure, so finding that out and then reflecting back on the letrozole cycles, I'm sure that added some complexity to how you're feeling. And
100%. There was so much frustration and so much hurt there, right? Because one, something was put into my body that I probably did not need.
Right.
And then two, right, because I feel like when people think about like fertility and infertility, everything is described as time. Mm-hmm. And so my initial anger was like, I just lost 6 to 9 months of time by doing something that my body didn't need. And so when I got that diagnosis, there was just so much frustration and the underscore during this period of my journey was just like, how did we get here? How did we get here? And so, yeah, so I dove into Asherman syndrome because I never heard about it in my life. Started to Google, found Facebook communities of other folks going through Asherman syndrome. And to find out that when you read about it, it's still considered rare. But then when you're in the community, it doesn't feel rare at all.
Right? Yeah. And I have to say, too, is that it doesn't feel rare to me anymore. Just based on the podcast guests I've had.
Yes.
There's been multiple people that have brought up Asherman syndrome and I've only been recording for 6 weeks. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there saying that there's probably even more people. And the reason why it's underdiagnosed is that there are still doctors even out there that don't really know what Asherman syndrome is. And so when you bring it up, they don't have a baseline to even know how to diagnose you. And then the other crazy thing is to find a specialist that specializes in Asherman syndrome to remove those adhesions. There's something crazy, 20 in the country.
Wow. There's one in Boston, right? I've heard of that one. Yeah.
Yes. Dr. Isaacson. He's one of the biggest ones that's out there. And there are people, right? I'm in those Facebook pages and I'm seeing people who are flying from California to Boston and flying, right, to have access to this. And I really lucked out that there are two in the area of which I live. And the doctor that I wound up going with is a woman and also a woman of color. And it was divine intervention that we met. even though my story doesn't end out ideally. Like, you know, it happened to be that, like, I call in, like, June or something crazy like that. And they're like, well, she doesn't have any openings until October. And so I hang up the phone. I cry, right? Like, what is happening? And then I call back.
Like you said, the time piece there.
Yeah. Right. I'm like, okay, so here goes another, like, 6 months, like, just to even get in for an initial appointment. And so I cry. Like, I don't make the appointment right there because I couldn't even, like, process it. And so then I pick up the phone again and I call. And the woman's like, oh, somebody just canceled. Do you want to come in tomorrow? And I remember, yeah. And I remember being like, yes, put me in. Right. And I'm giving her my birthday. And then she asked for my husband's birthday. And then she goes, oh, wow, two Pisces, like, living in a house together. And I'm like, I will talk about my astrological sign after I know that I have this appointment.
Please. Yeah, yeah.
But it was like divine intervention that I was able to get in the next day. And I meet her and she is thorough and lovely. And, you know, she's reviewing everything. And because it was like in 24 hours, right, my REI, they were able, like, literally call her up on the phone because they're like, yes, you need to see her. We need, like, this girl's story already has just been so awful. And anything that we can do in order to, like, help her on her way, like, everybody was super invested. And so, you know, the doctor that I saw, she was absolutely amazing. And she was trauma-informed. And there were times that, like, you know, there were other folks who would come in and I know that they were capable, but she was like, no, I want to do this myself because I want to be able to dictate everything that I'm doing. So that way you feel like you are informed of what is happening to your body. And that was so healing for me.
Oh, yeah, it goes a long way. I mean, anybody who's trauma informed and in working with someone, especially in this vulnerable setting, goes so far.
100%. So she was lovely. And so we do hysteroscopies because that's the way that they go in and remove the adhesions is through the hysteroscopies. And so we do hysteroscopies like 3 through 6 over periods of time. Some of them are under sedation. Some of them are actually just like in the office. So like that's the other crazy thing is like some of them, she like I can watch her like up on a screen going in and removing and cutting and doing everything, which sounds super scary for some folks. For me, it was healing because I literally could see what was happening. And I remember they kept saying, like, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm fine. Just tell me what's happening. That's it. That's all I need to know. If you can just describe what I am seeing in front of me, I will be okay. And we will be okay. And it will be great. And we were super hopeful, super hopeful. Like, because even our doctor was like, you know what? I feel like if I'm able to get these adhesions out, like, you might be able to even have a baby naturally. And I feel really good about this. And things are great. And then we go into that very last one with that hope. And I remember waking up and my mom was with me. And she's crying. And the doctor had cried. And I can tell. Yeah, because she pulled my, and my mom tells me later, she pulled her into the room because, like, I gave my mom, like, a list of things to ask. Mm-hmm. And she was just like, because I don't think anybody had expected for the outcome to be what it was, which was that she was like, yeah, I got rid of the scarring, but your uterine cavity, like your endometrium is so scarred and so damaged and so small, like it's basically non-existent. And so there's no way that something's going to be able to implant there.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I remember just like being in the hospital and feeling like, again, the underscore, how did we get here?
Yeah.
How did we get here? So, yeah. And that's how I was first. And she was the one who then brought up, like, you might want to consider a gestational carrier.
And how did it feel to hear those words for the first time?
It was, I didn't really know what they meant, to be honest with you, because I think we hear the word surrogacy. And I think if the word surrogacy was used, I'd be like, okay, now I understand what we're talking about. But right, we use the term gestational carrier. And I remember, and it was hard. Like it really hit me because it felt like a couple of things. I was grieving a couple of things in that moment. I was grieving the ability to not just carry another child, but there was always this like feeling for me that like my redemption story for all of this is that if I had another chance, I would do it differently and I would ensure, right, like, you know, I would have a doula and it would look different and I would be able to like completely call the shots and how this would go. And so it felt like there was also grieving of like my original thought of a redemption story mm-hmm. in this. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, so I took, so I had a great boss and I took off for a week.
It's yeah. a great boss. Yeah.
Yes. Fantastic. And so I took off a week from work. And what I do that's part of my like healing is I probably like overly fixate on things and I just dive into looking at what is a gestational carrier, what is surrogacy, and what does this process even look like?
At that point, did you have it in your mind that your redemption story could be different, or did it take a bit to get to that point?
Yeah, it did take a while for it to be to that point. I think at the very beginning, I was thinking about it logically. It was all logical, no emotion, because I wasn't ready to face the emotional piece of like grieving one story to open up the, you know, a change or a plot twist.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I wasn't ready for it. But then the more that I started, you know, I started to like join secondary infertility groups and I started to join surrogacy groups. And that's when I started to realize that like, okay, this could totally still be our redemption story. And I still have choice in this. Even if I'm not carrying my child, I still have choice. And ultimately, that's what the redemption was about choice.
Where did you start the looking up and the researching for yourself, the surrogacy and gestational carriers? How did you get started with that?
Yeah, Google. And that is terrible. Well, Google.
I feel like so many. I feel like, yeah, I mean, Google done right can be. Yeah, no, I get you. So yes. You started on Google and you said you looked up both the secondary infertility and the surrogacy route. And then when you started looking up the surrogacy route, you said you found Facebook groups and that kind of thing. Did you find that to be helpful for you? And tell me more about that.
Of course. Yeah. So I started to look up the Facebook groups. So resolve.org is a phenomenal resource. And that's sort of where I started getting a part of groups. And then people were telling me word of mouth, like, Facebook is the way to go. And so when I was in these groups, it was super helpful because it was people asking the same questions that I had. Like, hi, I'm starting. Where do I start? Like, where can I even get an understanding of, you know, surrogacy and a gestational carrier? Am I allowed to use both of those words together interchangeably?
What's the answer to that?
Yes. The answer is yes, you can. But like when you join this world and you're like, okay, this is new. And I don't know the jargon and I don't know the lingo. And I, you know, people are saying like independent surrogacy journey versus an agency. And so I remember like typing into like the search function of just like acronyms. And luckily somebody had already put together a Word document that was like, here are all the acronyms you're going to hear. And so the Facebook groups were super helpful for me. I got a really good start. I got to know where, and then I got to know where to go to. And I was connected with The Biggest Ask.
That's a great page. Yeah.
It's a phenomenal page and an even better resource, right? So there, if you see their page is phenomenal. And if you're
and we
going
can link it in the show notes too. I think we'll link, I mean, we'll have many links in these show notes, but yes. Resolve, The Biggest Ask.
100%. Their website is even better. They actually have like short tutorials about like how to get started. And like, here's like all of the pieces to know about surrogacy and gestational carriers. So I went to their page and I started to like watch these things, and they have a timeline. And that's really where I spend a lot of my time. But and also while doing all of this, I found that, you know, there weren't a lot of people who looked like me. And like, that's where things started that I was like, okay, so like, I feel comfortable here, but I also like, don't. Like, I would go to secondary infertility support groups because I sort of fell in two categories. Like, I was in secondary infertility support groups, and then I was like the only person who was trying to grow their family by surrogacy. And then I would go to surrogacy support groups. And right. And some folks, it was secondary infertility. Some folks, it was primary infertility.
Yeah. That was a question I was going to ask. Did you find in the surrogacy support groups, was it split or was it, did it lean more towards first pregnancies or secondary infertility?
Yeah. So it mostly leaned towards first pregnancies. And so like, I found myself sort of straddling these two groups of like, not really. And like fitting in both, but not fitting in both. And I was like the only person of color in both of them.
Yeah. So like the three different, like you said, the straddling of two. I mean, but it's like you're between three different really important big things.
100%. And you know, and it's interesting because it's like there's something that is extremely healing about the surrogacy like Facebook groups, which is this idea that information is passed just through like word of mouth. Like that's just where we are really when it comes to surrogacy. Yes, there are some pages. Yes, you know, there's folks like the Biggest Ask, but they're all grassroots, which is lovely. And it's all like word on the street. And that piece at least was healing because there, like for me, there's a connection to like Black culture that like all information is like word on the street, you know, through a friend, somebody's auntie said, hey, girl, let me tell you how like I got here. And I was finding that in the surrogacy groups, which actually made it extremely easy then for me to navigate.
Because you're used to that way of storytelling and connecting. Is that
100%? Mm-hmm. Yes.
100%.
Yeah. So it was easy for me to go through and then like read through comments. And then, like, ask, like, you know, follow-up questions. It was a really – and it felt less clinical, I think, and more relational, which is what I needed at that point and still need. But everything was through conversation. Like, I remember somebody being like, hey, everyone, how do y'all play for this?
That's a huge question, I feel like. When I was talking to Jessie, which her episode will air too, they'll be pretty close together and when they air, but she gave me a range of 100,000 to 200,000 and said, let me explain like why this range is so big. But then it's also like to almost anybody I would assume that hears those numbers, they're like, what? How do I come up with that? Like, where does that
come from? Yes. And you feel at first like it's so taboo because you're like, am I the only one thinking about this? Like, what is happening? And somebody else writes in the group like, hey, guys, like, how are y'all paying for this? And somebody replies with like, oh, honey, we're all in debt. Like, none of us are Kim Kardashian.
How just like relatable and just it seems like the barriers and the walls are just stripped down. It's like, hey, listen, like this is the reality of it. This is like we're all in it together. Many of us can't afford to just drop $100,000 at the drop of a hat. But like this is how we do it. I think that's amazing that conversation was had.
So relatable. And it was probably like the biggest exhale that I ever had because I was like, there truly are people that are like me and who are going through this and have the same questions. And we're all just like, well, we all have stumbled upon this thing that is in our lives. And we're all going to make the best of it. And you know what? Let me just like I feel like if it wasn't Facebook, like this would be a cookout, right? Like this would be people bringing their own dishes in order to feed you and to nourish you based off of like their own experiences, also going through the journey. And we're all just sort of like hanging out at a picnic, trying to all, you know, make it through a destination. It was great.
I feel like that's the beauty of social media. I know there's many things about social media that can be unhealthy or that can cause people to feel less than or feel anxious or you name it. But I feel like the good parts of social media are the parts that connect people who are in really unique experiences and make them feel a lot less alone. So that's incredible that you found that. And I love that you made the analogy to like a cookout where people are getting together in community, even though it's virtual.
100%. So that was that sort of like started like, you know, finding out more about gestational carriers and surrogacy and what it is, and also doing it without feeling extremely overwhelmed. Like it was definitely mm-hmm. overwhelming when I first started, and it's still overwhelming now, but it feels less overwhelming because I feel like I'm not doing it by myself.
Yeah. Gosh, that's incredible. And I wanted to talk too about your Instagram page, and I'm sure that you and people that stumble across your Instagram page have that feeling of not doing it themselves, especially people that fall into the three or two of the three categories that you listed, secondary infertility, using a gestational carrier, or part of the Black and Brown community. Like, I feel like you bring such comfort to people who stumble upon your page for however they come across it. So can you tell us a little bit more about your page, 5,000 Loaves?
Of course. So I'm Loaves, and it was like set up exactly from what you just described, which is this idea is that like I felt like I was sitting in groups and even sometimes on Facebook, and I was like, okay, like where are the Black people at? And it's funny because in the Black community, before you like go somewhere, like the common like phrase that you say is like, who all gonna be there? And like it's your way trying to you know, navigate and figure out like, all right, like, am I down with this group? Like, who am I going to have to navigate? Am I going to know somebody who's there? And I found up being like, where are all the Black people at? Where are they? And so 5,000 Loaves was like a way of like, okay, we need more representation. And this is sort of where the behavior analysis piece comes in of like, I started asking the question of like, well, why? Right? Like just statistics wise, there are more Black people out there that have experienced infertility or secondary infertility or going through surrogacy. Also, there has to be Black surrogates out there somewhere. Yeah. And so I started to figure out like why. And then also I wanted to be part of the solution of having another voice that's out there. And so 5,000. And then also I just wanted to find like a playlist of my life in this current point in time. And so that's how 5,000 Loaves was sort of born. And I know people are like, all right, 5,000 Loaves, like what's up with the bread? What's up with it? And for
it's
me,
tied to a Bible verse, right?
Yes, that is in the correct. Bible.
Yeah.
Yep. Connected to the Bible. It's connected to like the story where like, you know, a small child, you know, Jesus is trying to like feed a large crowd and some kid shows up. And I'm going to say it in my very like layman's terms. Some kid shows up with like 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And right. I imagine Jesus was like, yeah, all right, cool. Cool, dude. Like the math ain't mathin. He takes it as like a gift and he multiplies it. And he's able to feed like 50,000 people even with food to spare. And, you know, it's funny, like it's a miracle. But I do sort of write that like that's actually not the most prominent thing for me. Like it's a miracle. Yes, people were fed. But there is no story without small resources. This story doesn't belong unless there were feelings of doubt, because like these people are hungry and they need to be fed. And I've been hungry before and even hungry like now. I'm hungry for a second child. That 100% is what it is. And there are days where it feels impossible, you know, either financially or emotionally, or those days where I do think about like, how did we get here? It can feel impossible. And then I look around and I realize I have resources and there are folks who have less than me. And then I get angry about our maternal care system. And so really it just like resonated with me about this idea of like, yeah, this world can be brutal. Sometimes it feels like it can take, and sharing can sometimes feel risky. Hope can sometimes feel risky. But ultimately, even with small resources, we can feed the masses. Like that's what these Facebook groups are doing. It's one person who's like, well, let me tell you a little bit about my experience. And hopefully that nourishes you, that feeds you. And, you know, if we sort of sit in that and we sit in being confident in being storytellers, well, then multiplication can happen and hopefully big things can happen.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a good analogy, too, for, you know, the people that come into the Facebook group and say, hey, how are you all paying for this? And it's like step by step, or this is how we're doing it. I looked up the 5,000 Loaves after I found your Instagram page. And yeah, what a powerful story. And something else I wanted to bring up about your Instagram page is on your stories, you often feature Black joy. So can you tell us about that and like why that's so important for you to share on your Instagram page and how you pick out the different things that you do share?
100%. And so exactly as you said, like I try at least every day to have these like daily moments of Black joy. And part of the reason was that like I found when I was first starting this page and I was like sharing my story, it was so easy to get into like the space of just like our maternal healthcare system. Like, let's talk about like, you know, medical gaslighting and all of those pieces and some of like the struggles that it is to be, you know, a Black person trying to navigate maternal healthcare, you know, just medical care, all of that. And I realized that like that is still not part of the story and that's still not part of my story. Right. Like I'm a full person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a saying out there that like being Black and joyful against and despite all of the odds is an act of resistance because like we're not just suffering like and we're not suffering. Right. Like we are navigating in a system that is trying to have us suffer. But the reality is that there is so much more to that for us. And we are joyful and we are picnicking and dancing and singing and right watching the clouds and owning dogs and doing all of these wonderful and joyful things. And so as much as I wanted to share like the really hard truths that it is to navigate these oppressive systems, I also wanted to say that like despite all of this, here we are living and being the joyful people that we are, and that every day along with this is an and situation. Joy is always there. Joy is always a piece of that. And my people, right? Like we live in joy as well. So
I try to
include it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You made me tear up. I love that. I think that's so powerful. I think just in general, like you said, the joy is there and you named off all of these things. And I think when you're going through your experience navigating the medical system, I know we talked about deserts in terms of the play deserts, but I think about Chicago and I think that's where I am.
Yeah.
And I believe it was Regina from The Broken Brown Egg. Do you follow her? Yeah. She posted something a while back that's really stood out to me about like a map of Chicago and where the fertility clinics are located.
Yes.
And my husband and I are familiar. We lived in the city for a while, and my husband worked on the west side and I worked on the south side when we first moved here. And those communities are predominantly Black, and there was no fertility clinics in those communities. And so like seeing that just mapped out said a lot with it, just a picture, you know? So I think it's really important that you're talking about this, but then also bringing the joy piece in. Because that's something I really value too with holding both is that we all know infertility is so hard. We all know infertility just sucks. But for me, and the message that I want to get across to people is that like I'm going to validate how much it sucks, but I'm also not going to twist in the knife because there is joy to be had in this experience of secondary infertility and having your child. Yes. And like there is moments of joy from being a mom and from experiencing the moments of joy in mothering, also the challenges, but then like holding the pain and yearning of infertility, but the pain and yearning isn't the only thing.
Yes.
And I love how you brought in the holding both piece with the Black experience is that in systems that are not designed to be supportive, like awful, but you're not going to ever let that joy go. And to be able to share that joy and to be able to bring up these pictures is so powerful. And to see that just makes me smile. I love seeing that on your page. So thank you for sharing that.
Of course. No, thank you. I will say that the highlight sometimes of my day is like scrolling through Black Twitter and scrolling these things to like find these moments of joy. It's the joy of my day, and I love being able to share them with others as like, you know, hopefully this is like your, if anything, like here's your daily dose of joy.
Yeah. I mean, that's really cool too, that you're going to to seek those moments out or seek those pictures out to share with others. But it's not even inadvertently, but it's serving the function first of bringing you the joy to find it and then to share it with others. So I think that is so incredible. I next wanted to talk about, just to wrap up here, what makes you outside of motherhood? What do you love and what lights you up?
So things that I absolutely love and lights me up is, one, I enjoy eating tacos with my friends. I will find a place where there are tacos, you know, playing Uno with my family, listening to music and finding songs that sit with me in the current moments of which I'm in writing. And then finally, I love plants. I have very many of plants in my home. Some would argue that it's a problem. I say that it is an existential hobby for the amount of plants that I have. So
what does your husband say about the plants?
Oh, my word. Because he loves me, he smiles when I can bring more plants in. But like, there's definitely moments where he's like, why do we have so many? Like my son had his fourth birthday. We had a bunch of children, you know, in our living space, and they're about to, and he's handing out pizza. And like, while he's handing out pizza, he goes to stand up and like hits his head on one of like my hanging plants. And I definitely have it, like the picture of him like looking at me like, why is this plant here? Like, why are they hanging from the ceiling?
That's would you say you have a favorite plant? I know you mentioned in your bio the fig leaf and keeping it alive.
Yes.
Is that your favorite plant? Or
that is my favorite. And it's also probably like the most like high maintenance one that I have, because it's come a very long way. It's been with us since we've moved. It's been with us since, right, like my son has been born and we have a dog. Like it is really hanging on here.
Yeah. Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. But every once in a while it tries to like fake death. And I don't know if it's like its way of telling me of like, you have not spent as much time with me. Do you remember when it was just the two of us? So that's the one that I'm always trying to ensure that I keep alive.
That takes special skill. I'm impressed. How many plants would you say you have, if off the top of your head?
Goodness. I have at least, I probably have like 30 plants in my house.
Wow. Oh my gosh. I'm sure that's beautiful. That's really,
yes,
really,
really
cool.
I think it's gorgeous.
I've really enjoyed this conversation. Can you tell listeners where they can find you?
Of course. So you can find me on Instagram at 5000 loaves, all spelled out. And so you can find me there.
Great. And I will link that to the show notes. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed this.
Me too.
I hope you found this episode of the Secondary Infertility Podcast to be meaningful. One of the best ways to support me and my show is to rate and leave a review. For more secondary infertility content, please come find me at Holding Both on Instagram. That's HOLDINGBOTH on Instagram. Thank you.